Hey, everybody, welcome. We have from Toronto, Ruth, welcome. We have over nearly 500 registrations. We have a network of nearly 5,000 people. That means recordings are accessed by people from 138 countries. That's our reach right now. It's getting better. I welcome you all to Heritage Matters webinars. I know there are so many webinars, so many online things. It's fantastic. I think thanks to COVID-19, you know, everybody has got used to a range of platforms and technologies. They're communicating even more, expressing themselves even more. It's beautiful. I think we should be doing this post-COVID, continue this kind of Farah from Algeria, welcome. And we should be doing this post-pandemic too. I think it's wonderful to be in the digital domain communicating. But let me say one thing, post-pandemic, we're not going back to where we were, which is very much, you know, face-to-face. But we are now so technologically competent, so savvy, net savvy, it'll be blended environment. It'll be even more enriched than before. So I feel really excited, you know, A, for the pandemic to be over, B, for the post-pandemic reality, a kind of new world that we can determine what it is. Because remember, everybody says new normal, but the question is, who is going to define what is new normal? Those of us who are engaged in the blended world, we are the ones who are going to define it. Arundhati Roy, the well-known Indian writer, she has written an article called the pandemic as a portal. And in summary, what she says is that we have to go through the portal of the pandemic. We can continue to drag all the things that we want to, all the baggage, or we can shed the baggage. I think what most of us involved in Heritage Matters will be doing is we will shed the baggage and we will move forward with a bright tomorrow that we all look forward to, in a blended environment, learning environment, conversation environment, and in a very highly enriched world. But in doing this, one of the things that we really need to shed our baggage is also colonialism. Our heritage discourse in many parts of the world, you find Black Lives Matter in the US, Black Lives Matter in Australia, many other countries. It's all to do with decolonizing our minds. It's dealing with racism. And also this thing about, you know, the environment, you know, the 19th century mentality of the environment is there to be exploited, raped, and pillaged, and make money at any cost. We can't do that anymore with the climate crisis. So the triangulation of COVID-19, the triangulation of the demands for rights and equality, COVID-19 has exposed the inequalities and the climate crisis, it's real. Today there was a statistic, how much of the Arctic ice cap has melted in the last 1 week. And so there are huge issues. We're all in this together, just like the pandemic has shown us. Nobody is immune to it. There are no borders for it. It's across the world, rich, whatever, it didn't matter. Climate change is the same. It's all of us. Ice caps might melt in the Arctic, but the water levels are rising in the Pacific, and you have Kiribati, Tuvalu, two countries which are almost going underwater. New Zealand, whose Prime Minister amazes all of us, has generously offered to resettle people from Tuvalu and Kiribati in New Zealand gradually. We need to be sharing in this new world. So what happened 20 years ago, or 21 years ago, Darjeeling Himalayan Railway was inscribed on the World Heritage List in Marrakesh at the World Heritage Committee meeting. However, it was inscribed without all the prerequisites, like a buffer zone, like a conservation, you know, office, you name it. And I was asked by UNESCO Delhi office if I could come and help. Why come and help? Because nobody asked the local Gurkhas, nobody asked the local people in Darjeeling whether they would like Darjeeling Himalayan Railway on the World Heritage List. Nobody asked them. So they decided, how dare you do this? This is our our land, our place. Thank God, World Heritage people have come a long way. I'm not saying it's Paris, it's a whole range of people who work in this industry. They've come a long way. But for me, I came back, I spent 3 months going up and down the line, as they say in Darjeeling, from 200 feet in Siliguri all the way to Gum, 8,600 feet, and down to 8,300 feet in Darjeeling. And Gum is higher than Darjeeling. So I worked on 17 stations. I worked on right across with change teams across each area, where we formed community groups. And then we had a huge meeting to discuss. And the issue that came up is the people locally valued their heritage, which nobody asked. But the people who came from outside really wondered, but this is not really, you know, we have the Taj Mahal, we have Ajanta, we have Sanchi, but this is why this is World Heritage. And so it was a very weird situation where the Gurkhas and the Lepchas and everybody that was in the final workshop valued, but actually the highly educated, so-called educated people from outside were the ones who couldn't understand. And this is where, for me, it was like a revelation. I was living in Australia. I came back just for the time to work there. And so since I come back from Australia about 5 years ago to work in India, we have somebody from Mongolia who says hello to everybody, you know, sort of, so see our reach. And so what I found is that, I mean, for me, the disaster at Pragati Maidan pulling down, you know, that amazing building with which I, as a, you know, a person who studied in Delhi, had a very long association, was quite devastating. There was huge protest in India. But the thing is, the protest came a bit late. There should have been the momentum for us to rethink what is heritage and what is modern heritage. We should have already started doing that. We didn't do that. And for that, all of us are responsible. We all take responsibility, but it's water under the bridge, but we move forward. But how do we move forward? Through critical advocacy, through research, through demonstration projects. And we need to illustrate to people what is modern heritage. You know, that's the only way people will understand, because it's part of the decolonizing process, if you will. And lastly, the one thing that shocked me in India, because this is something we addressed in South Africa, where I worked for 5 years during the first president's time, Australia, New Zealand, many other countries, but India did not, is when I came here, people were saying vernacular architecture, vernacular houses, curios for souvenirs, ethnic. Anything that was Indian was called ethnic in shops. And I was shocked. I said that this is all colonial legacies. And this is what's happened is with modernity, it's fragmented us. It's created those binaries of, you know, modernity and that which is local, which was put in a hierarchical position at the subordinate level. And only decolonization process would help us to rethink all these things. And for that, we have fantastic panel of people today. And we'll initially hear from Eric Fault. Eric is the director of UNESCO New Delhi office, which is a cluster office. We'll start with him. And then we have Shika Jain, who is a walking encyclopedia of not only world heritage, but all forms of heritage. And I'm not going to do detailed introductions because you would all Google them. That's been the tendency on Heritage Matters, that people Google before they register. So we have Shika, Dr. Shika Jain. She's past advisor and multiple grantee for the Keeping It Modern initiative of Getty Foundation. That's exactly what she's going to focus on. And then we have Amita Beg, India's representative for the World Monuments Fund. And she's going to focus also on Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel Stadium in Ahmedabad. I'm one of the 5 jury members in the World Monuments Fund in New York. And we listed it in our watch list, the stadium. So it's wonderful that, you know, it's also got the Getty grant. And then we have, because in our webinars, we always have the next generation, which is basically to make me feel young. But anyway, Nishita Kedia. Nishita is assistant professor in School of Architecture at Anant National University, a young architect from Northeastern India who will reflect on her own learnings and understandings coming to a place like Ahmedabad. And I didn't introduce myself. My name is Amareshwar Galla. People call me Amar. Sometimes they send my own publications to me saying this bastard has plagiarized your work. So because they don't know it's the same guy. So call me Amar. I'm professor of inclusive cultural leadership. I also head the UNESCO Unit for Member Center, the International Center for Inclusive Cultural Leadership at Anant National University. And I already mentioned I was a jury member with the World Monuments Fund. So those are our introductions. And without any more delay, we will listen to Eric Faulkner. Eric could not join us in the last minute because of a personal issue. However, he kindly sent the recording and it's going to be shared now.
Amar and friends and colleagues, first of all, I would like to apologize for not being able to participate in this webinar as I had planned. And nevertheless, I wanted to say a few words to introduce the topic of modern heritage. Essentially, over the last three decades, international policy advocacy for heritage has increasingly recognized the wider concept of heritage beyond monuments and archaeological sites to include other categories, such as, for instance, intangible cultural heritage, but also modern heritage. However, it's quite clear that modern heritage still continues to be unknown and largely unprotected. And an encouraging trend for India has been that recently urban heritage with modern architectural ensembles have been promoted through, in particular, but not exclusively, the World Heritage nomination. One thinks, of course, of the architectural work of Le Corbusier, a transnational serial nomination with 17 sites across seven countries, including India, celebrating the architect's work, which includes the complex of the capital in Chandigarh, which actually became part of the World Heritage List in 2016. Another example of modern heritage inscribed on the World Heritage List is also the Victorian Gothic and Art Deco ensembles of Mumbai, which were inscribed in 2018, recognizing the modern heritage of the 19th and 20th centuries that evolved in Mumbai as part of the different phases of its urban evolution. A third example, perhaps, to introduce the concept to those who may not know much about it, is the mountain railways of India, including Darjeeling Himalayan Railway, Kalka Shimla Railway, and the Nilgiri Mountain Railway. That's another significant example of modern heritage, more specifically industrial heritage in India, which was also inscribed on the World Heritage List. Perhaps here it's worth noting that the introduction of railway infrastructure due to technological advancements at the time led to significant developments for the economy of the regions. Darjeeling over time became synonymous with finest tea production and its export globally. And that's why it was worthy of inclusion as part of modern heritage. Today, these hill railways continue to remain vital for these regions and communities. So beyond these sites that are already inscribed, there are a few modern heritage sites on India's tentative list of World Heritage Sites, such as the Cellular Jail in the Andaman Islands, and also Santiniketan in West Bengal. Let us see how these nomination evolve, but these are certainly two properties which deserve wider attention and protection. In fact, India in its post-independence era has witnessed the growth of several institutions that have played an important role in its trajectory. These include educational and research institutions, also cultural institutions, cultural spaces like museums, galleries, theaters, important government buildings sometimes, and also public housing projects. Many of these are, in fact, iconic structures in terms of modern heritage sensibilities drawn from universal trends, as well as combined with elements of India's inherent architectural traditions. These structures have been integral to the landscape of the places they belong to. So it is quite important to create greater sensitization of all stakeholders on the need to recognize modern heritage, and it is certainly that something that cannot be emphasized enough. This seems to be, in fact, a critical first step to enrich the perceptions related to what constitutes heritage. The efforts towards awareness raising and protection require participation of everybody, an understanding by everybody, including, of course, the experts who are with us for the webinar today, but civil society, educational institutions, and local communities. That's also very important because they have a strong connection to the places and heritage around them. With that, dear Amar, I would like to wish you good luck for the continuation with this webinar, and I know we will be in touch very shortly. Thank you very much.
Amar, so you're on mute.
Thank you, Eric. I will pass on the message. I've already sent on WhatsApp a thank you message to Eric. It's wonderfully and very succinctly put. Now over to Dr. Shikha Jain. Shikha, I'm not going to say what you're going to say. You just say what you want to say. You know best. Over to you, Shikha. Doesn't she look gorgeous? Look at her backdrop. Go on.
So, thank you, Amar, for that introduction. And it was a really nice beginning address from Eric, introducing, you know, the World Heritage and how we have, India has, you know, made a conscious effort to place more sites on the World Heritage List belonging to the modern heritage. So, in fact, this is a gap that we realized sometime in 2012 when we were revising the tentative list. And I and Amita Beg here, we were part of the tentative list revision committee for India. And we got a lot of suggestions from various organizations like ECOMOS India, also from stakeholders in Chandigarh and other places where there is modern heritage. So we got these special recommendations saying there should be more modern heritage, which was a gap that we had already identified as per the gap analysis of UNESCO. And that's how we were able to consciously actually nominate certain modern world heritage, which Eric has spoken about, Chandigarh as the transnational, as well as Mumbai, both were at that time in the process of application. They were already on the tentative list, but at the same time, we were able to add more. And, one important one that we added on the tentative list was the Baha'i Temple that you can see, just above me out here. So this is like 1986 modern heritage and one of the best examples. And it's a privately owned structure. So, it was really a great initiative. This was through ECOMOS India, but the very fact that the Baha'i Trust themselves came forward and they placed it on the tentative list was a, big step for us to especially talk about modern heritage of the 1980s, which is quite recent, I would say. So this is, about World Heritage, which Eric has already covered a lot. UNESCO also has a modern heritage special program, and that works towards looking at modern heritage aspects specifically. And currently our colleague, Mrs. Jyoti Hosagrahar, who was also part of the revision committee for the tentative list, she's currently heading that modern heritage program in UNESCO Paris right now. So coming to now, what is the status of heritage, modern heritage in India? I mean, looking at all this gap and World Heritage processes, there were other international organizations such as the Getty Foundation, the Getty Conservation Institute, who started Modern Heritage Initiatives. Getty Foundation started a special funding for modern heritage. It's called KIM, Keeping It Modern. And they started in 2014. Since then till now, this 2020 was the year of closing that grant process. They've actually funded 77 projects across various countries. And amongst them, three of them are in India, and I happen to be the principal consultant for these three. You can see that two of the buildings on my left side, which is the Gandhi Bhavan, we got the implementation grant for that. It was given to the Punjab University, which is a complex, complete institutional campus post-independence, which is built with several modern heritage structures. And this one, Gandhi Bhavan, was built by Pierre Jeanneret. And then below that, you see the museum designed by Le Corbusier. I mean, in his entire lifespan, he designed three museums which got realized. These three, one of them is in Tokyo, which is part of the 17 sites inscribed as the transnational in under architectural works of Le Corbusier. The second one is in Ahmedabad, Sanskar Kendra, and this is the third one in Chandigarh, which was his last project. So this is, it shows his experiment with museum buildings and his concept of museum in modernism, which is another aspect probably. I mean, today is not the forum to discuss that, but it requires its own, discussion on how museum form itself or museum architecture changed with the impact of modernism. So this was an initiative of the Getty Foundation. It did help in raising awareness, amongst the Indian community, especially amongst the Indian architects who and conservation architects. A number of them got engaged with this process of conservation. Gandhi Bhavan was also the first one that prepared a comprehensive conservation management plan, which is currently has got the implementation grant this year in 2020, and we will be implementing the entire conservation plan that was envisaged. Also, another point that I wanted to really discuss was, the status of modern heritage in India, looking at, what is really the quantum. I mean, Chandigarh, of course, we all know, it was designed as a modern city. It was post-independence when our Prime Minister invited Corbusier, and it was linked with the nation identity, how modern India should perceive architecture. And it worked like a laboratory for modern architecture at that time when Corbusier came with his team of Pierre Jeanneret, and then of course there were Jane Drew and who designed the rest of the city. But this, the kind of impact it had on the architects, the contemporary architects who were there, who interned with Corbusier and Pierre Jeanneret, who were influenced to a certain extent. And of course, we know the renowned names like Mr. B.V. Doshi, Anant Rajay, Raj Rewal, Jeet Malhotra, Mr. S.D. Sharma, who's still practicing in Chandigarh. And these were the architects who initially, learned from Corbusier and Pierre Jeanneret. But later on, they developed their own vocabulary of architecture, and which was more linking to, indigenous values. And it's something that has been categorized as critical regionalism by a number of architectural critiques. And this brought in a new wave of modern architecture in India, which are the buildings like the Hall of Nations, one of them which we have lost. They still need to be recognized. And of course, one of them getting the Getty grant this year, Amita will talk about it more. It's really, we are fortunate that we got this grant for a building like that in India, because it will really impact, and influence the minds of people in realizing the value of such modern architecture built by our own contemporary architects post-independence. The reason why modern architecture has not been recognized or modern heritage in India is something that we really need to review and, you know, reflect on, because it's very important for us to understand how modern heritage needs to be valued, who should value it, and that is what is actually lead to protection. The problem with our, you know, Heritage Act is like the Archaeological Survey of India or the state archaeology that follow that act, which is under culture, they only recognize heritage which is 100 years old. So of course, I mean, just by default, by the number of years, none of the modern structures would fall under that category, and it excludes them from protection. But fortunately, we have a local level law, the urban bylaws, and there are a lot of local level initiative which can also be taken for its protection. And the best of examples of that is Chandigarh and Bhubaneswar. These are two cities which have master plans that recognize modern heritage. And, you know, they have categories such as heritage precincts, heritage structures in grade 1, 2, and 3. And they have a special heritage committee. So for Chandigarh, which is, you know, an excellent example, the previous chief architect, Mrs. Sumit Kaur, was very actively involved in drafting that master plan. And it's really a big support for protecting the heritage of Chandigarh, because all these buildings are listed and graded. And if anyone wants to make a change or, you know, do any work, then they have to go through this special heritage committee, which was at one point also chaired by Mr. Raj Rewal. It has other eminent architects and of Chandigarh. So I would say Chandigarh is really one example where we can see how people of Chandigarh, it's not only the architects, of course, they have taken a lead, but the people of Chandigarh themselves have taken ownership of their heritage as modern heritage. And even in Bhubaneswar, that is another master plan. It was prepared by Dr. Sangamitra Basu. She was actively involved in that. And that's another example where we see a complete city or urban heritage, you know, with that modern modernism value that is being recognized. So what I understand is that in India, wherever we have a cluster or, you know, urban heritage at large, which is, you know, from modernism period, that has been recognized and some kind of protection is there, even for the Art Deco, of course, which is now World Heritage in Mumbai. But when it comes to individual buildings, whether it's Hall of Nations or if it's a museum somewhere, or, you know, it could be in Pondicherry, the Raymond building and others, then it's very difficult, because the Culture Act does not incorporate that kind of protection. It's the 100 years block that we face. And also those single structures are recognized and appreciated more by the architectural community. So we as architects understand and we know the value, but then the others in the surroundings or local citizens, stakeholders don't really associate with such structures. They are not looking at, you know, the architectural details or the form, etc. It's difficult for them to understand. And I don't think as our community is also communicating that in the right manner. So I think that is one important aspect that we need to look at if we really are, if we want to save the modern heritage in India. And of course, how much of this heritage exists in India is another question, because we do not have a quantity as such. You know, we really need to do inventorying and mapping. To some extent, the ICOMOS India Scientific Committee on Modern Heritage, they are working on this kind of mapping. It is in process. But we really need to have a complete inventory to then go forward and suggest or recommend to the government that this could have some kind of protection. So these are the key issues, you know, that I wanted to present regarding modern heritage in India.
Thank you, Shekhar. That's fantastic. Thank you, Shekhar. What In just about 8 minutes, I don't know how you managed to cover everything. You have such a fantastic perspective. Before we go over to Amita, I want you as well as other panelists could also think about, because I am getting some messages directly rather than through the organizers, ownership. This is a big issue for us in India, you know, ownership of heritage, whether it's World Heritage or local community ownership, for example. Second question relates to valuing. Do we measure? Is it qualitative? Is it quantitative? How does one deal with valuing? That's another question. Yes, we have a 100-year government of India, you know, the legislation, but can this be changed? What can the government of India do? Because they are introducing a whole range of new schemes. We're all familiar with the Hruday and Prasad, all these schemes, you know, where there are opportunities coming up. Would the government of India make some changes, maybe from 100 years to 50 years? I don't know. I, as an Australian, I would go based on assessing significance rather than how many years old, but different, you know, different countries, different approaches. And lastly, we have a new national education policy in India that's been launched after 34 years, about 2 weeks ago. And my own personal impression in India is that architecture faculties work in silos. Can these architecture faculties, architecture schools, I know some do work together beyond the silos, but the majority seem to work in silos. How much of this is going to be important for raising awareness if you're going to deal with modern heritage of India, that architects themselves take interdisciplinary approaches, both in research and practice? So you have some time to mull over it while Amita takes over. So Amita, over to you.
Thank you so much, Amar. Delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm going to pick up on the point you made, which is on values. And so to me, and I'm happy to debate this later, modern architecture marks a transition from the heritage of priests and princes to everyone's aspiration. And it's this transition, this new world of the 20th century, that I think, you know, as Said Zulfikar said, that architecture is a physical manifestation of civilization. Modern architecture is our moment in that story, and I think that's the value we need to bring to it. To me, it's not just exclusively about design or great presence, and although we know there is a huge amount, but I think what happens in the 20th century is there were increasing attempts at equality, driven by new builders of the modern world. It was the democratization of heritage. The fort was no longer locked away. It was Chhatrapati Shivaji railway station for everyone. And I think that democratization, that relationship with your with modern heritage is what I would like to see valorized much more. And unless we promote that value, we're going to be left with aesthetic judgments and subjective judgments on whether Rajarewala's building is more important than Louis Kahn or whoever. You know, we mustn't bring it to that. It's what that building meant in that moment in time. And I think particularly in the post-colonial world, there's a hugely deep social implication as new nations across the Africas and Asias sought to express their identity, their culture, and their reassertion of who they were. Not in the past, but who they are now. These were new nations looking for new idiom, new expression. Architecture is defining modern free societies. They also define changing worlds. I mean, remember that 100 years ago, 150 years ago, which is when we begin to talk about modernism, social fabric worldwide was changing from feudalism to a more egalitarian society. There was an opportunity to be employed in industry and no longer be a serf or a bonded labor. And if you took a building, there's a building in Moscow, just outside Moscow, called the Naskomfin building. It is dull beyond belief, boring, miles and miles of identical structures.
Amita ma'am?
Amita, you're frozen. Amita?
I think she's having connectivity issues.
That's a great shot of Amita, even though she's frozen, everybody can see. For people to think about before she comes back, reconnects, I'll just read out the questions that are coming in. I'm not going to take all the questions because some of them are very valid to do with floods and what's happening, but we are focusing on valuing modern heritage. So I'll only take questions that deal with valuing modern heritage. So there's a question here. Have been trying hard to get people in India to see the link between decolonization and modernization. This was through the India e-commerce, NSC 20C, IAC 20C. I don't know if all the foreign the participants can understand all this, but I'm sure you have your own acronyms. We Indians love them, of which I've been a member since 2004. I've been largely looking at the post-war era and modern architecture, but interestingly, their definition of modern is also now being revised to include the first half of 20th century, as well as the roots of modernization during COVID-19. So, and I think the panelists know who is asking this question. So that's from Kiran Joshi. Are you back, Amita? Amita, are you back? Hello? Technical support, can you help?
She's still frozen.
Okay, she's frozen. Okay, then the next question that's come up, I mean, those of you who are listening, Shika, you know, Nishchita, and I could also be dragged into this. Would Luton's Delhi, I know everybody's expecting this question, would Luton's Delhi, North-South Block, Parliament, Rashtrapati Bhavan be considered modern heritage? How would the plans to build Prime Minister's House and other structures affect its heritage status if it is considered to have one? That's a very interesting question. If it is considered to have one, my thing goes back to what I've found in India is that we're always reacting to things rather than being proactive. We need very strong professional bodies to do this and strong government advocacy as well. Okay, we're not getting her back, is it?
I'm here.
Okay, continue, please.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened.
But you look fabulous, the way you look, you know, frozen like this, yeah. Go ahead.
So I think that's an element I would like to introduce. I've lost the thread of what I was saying. A modern architecture has to have value, and it's that value we need to keep bringing in to when we look at these buildings. I mean, these are all markers in our development. It marks independent thought. It marks a whole architectural profession who had a stake in the future of India. And they all sought some expression, some positioning, because what we had was a massive amount of monuments. And what was going to be said about free, independent India, empowered with a new world? Amar talks about the Hall of Nations, which was the first and largest space frame structure built. And we all know the story, it got lost overnight, sadly. Well, you know, I think the value of the building was it was built to mark India's technological advancement of 25 years of its independence. That was what it spoke about, that we are evolved enough, we've matured enough, developed enough to build this extraordinary structure. We are marking 25 years of India's independence. It's a recognition of our own advancement. We've lost that. We have lost that marker. And it's exactly the same story as when you look at your ancient past. Each one has a narrative and a story and an embedded feeling in the future. For all of us, these are pillars, these are connectors. So I'd like to then talk about, you know, as Amar said, we now are working on the Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel Stadium in Ahmedabad, which is listed with the World Monuments Watch, and it's an iconic structure in the heart of the city. The time it was built, it was cutting edge design. And I, you know, what's very interesting is government contracts. It was a great design for a multi-purpose sports center, but only the stadium got built. So the opportunity you have now that, of course, stadiums are far more advanced, they offer far more facilities. And Ahmedabad, of course, has this huge new stadium. So our idea would be to bring it back into the lives of Ahmedabad citizens and say, look, here is a stadium which is going to address school children. Urban schools have no playing fields. They have no access to quality athletics and games and sports. I know certainly in Delhi, the children appear in the big stadiums the day before sports day and they all pretend they've trained all year. So we have no facility like that in any of our cities because the big stadiums are all shuttered away. They're not democratic spaces. So I would love to see the stadium come back and have a new invigorated life, whether it's a jogging track or the lives of the citizens. I think under the banner of Modern Heritage Matters, I think modern architecture, modern heritage matters. It matters because we tell our story. And every generation has a right to tell its own story. We owe that to our children, to our grandchildren. There must be new narratives, new stories. I would move them above any aesthetic judgment or technological advancements. And of course those are there, but they're also moments in the time of our history. And we are writing our history today. And we need to valorize what, you know, people did in the 50s, in the 60s, and before. And for me, that's especially important because we are a free country. You can say how wonderful Rashtrapati Bhavan is or the Art Deco and Gothic area of Mumbai, but those are really colonial cities.
Thank you, Amita.
That tells you your story.
Your passion is infectious. We all feel so inspired by you. Thank you so much. Now, we'll come back to the questions, but now we'll move on to Nishita Kedia. Nishita?
Nishita, you're on mute.
Can you unmute yourself?
Yes. A very good evening to everybody. I'm extremely delighted to be a part of this webinar today with the participants joining with us from different countries across the world. I'm not going to be very technical like my other respected panelists have already spoken about, but I would like to share with you experiences of my tryst with modern architecture that I have just penned down. I've been born and brought up in the northeastern part of India, which has a rich cultural backdrop and exhibits a strong identity of traditional architecture. This has been a major factor that influenced in the shaping of my identity and my understanding of architecture. The contextual setup, which was the driving force in the region, lent an architectural language which was very traditional and lacked traces of the aspects of modernism. My only learnings of modern architecture were restrained to the study of the subject as a student, of which I did not have many precedents to refer. The only modernist buildings around me seemed very unfit in the surrounding. This was the time when my curiosity to explore the values of modern architecture sparked. As many of you know that post-independence, after a long nationalist struggle for freedom, the need for a new identity expressing the aspirations of an independent India emerged. The political willpower of then leadership set up a perfect stage for modernism to enter India. The functionalist language of modern architecture represented a new style which was free of colonial association and references to traditions. Amidst the questions of identity and symbolism, Le Corbusier's Chandigarh provided a new reference point for the Indian architects. Unlike modern architecture of the West, which started in a clean slate environment post-World War, the modern architecture in India evolved as an influence to its connections with the past. While technology enabled the West to create a new form of architecture where pre-modern past played a lesser role, on contrary, the reconciliation of the ancient past with the spirit, systems, methods, and products of the modern world was widely adopted throughout India. One such center that graciously accepted modernism in its cultural context was Ahmedabad, a city that I live in, which is also referred to as the Mecca of modern architecture in India, and now also a UNESCO World Heritage City. My curiosity to explore modernism brought me to Ahmedabad, a city where vast cultural and architectural history harmoniously coexisted with profound architectural styles and avant-garde buildings by master architects of the time like Le Corbusier, Louis Kahn, B.V. Doshi, Charles Correia, to name a few. Ahmedabad's unique background of traditional architecture and the patronage of astute industrialists with a vision for the city became the reason behind emergence of some of the most prominent modern institutions in Ahmedabad. This also lent Ahmedabad the title of institution building capital of the country. My perception towards modernism further shaped up by working with architect Hasmukh C. Patel, or HCP, one of the most prominent architects who contributed in transforming the skyline of the city. His projects like the Patang Hotel, the Office of the Reserve Bank of India, and lately the Indian Institute of Management, which lent a visibility to the city while very cohesively blending with the works of Corbusier, Kahn, and others who had already made a significant impact on the society and culture of Ahmedabad. His body of works was characterized by the values of modern architecture like functionalism, clean lines, accurately located services, contextual response, and careful detailing and construction. It also represented the social and cultural aspects rationalized into architecture. My initial years in Ahmedabad also gave me the opportunity to visit some of the most iconic buildings like the Sanskar Kendra, Milloners Association, IIM Ahmedabad, and many more, which had a strong influence in shaping up my design thinking. As an outsider, I witnessed these examples of modern architecture not as an isolated product of a specific era, but as an integral part of the cultural identity in a multidimensional yet homogeneous setup. While I begin to appreciate the importance of these modern buildings, on a personal front, I also came across to understanding of people's disregard to the modernist style. In my opinion, one of the reasons for disregard in the general public for modern architecture is due to the subtle nuances in its expressions, which is in contrary and contrast to the traditional architecture, which has long been prevalent in the facade of the city. Another reason for the lack of appreciation of these buildings is the excessive influence of modern style in the prevailing built environment. Culture and built spaces are two very interlinked concepts, which helps to create meaningful environments with unique identity and lends a sense of belongingness to the local people. In order to achieve this, these modern structures can be reimagined as a thriving centers of cultural activities. Couple of such examples are the annual events like the Abhivyakti at Sanskar Kendra and Raw Collaborative at Milloners Association, which have reinstated the identity of these iconic buildings by society inclusions. Also, as an academician, I believe that there is a greater responsibility of architecture institutions in creating awareness among students and the society by introducing pedagogical exercises in collaboration with these buildings. I would like to end this conversation with a question that I came to Ahmedabad with. As it is believed that architecture reflects the culture of a place and the modern structures in Ahmedabad has been successful in doing so, can it be seen as a moral responsibility of a city, its culture, and the people to protect the modern heritage that essentially helped the city to form its own identity? Though utmost necessary, preserving modern heritage should not be looked from legal and institutional framework only, but I think it should become a public movement by engaging them to realize the value of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Nishita. How well put. Thank you so much. That's fantastic. I think we had three superb presentations from our three panelists, and of course initially by our director of UNESCO Center. This is really wonderful. Questions are coming through. They're coming through in different ways, and I'm going to collapse them because that's the only way to deal with them. I would like all the three of you to take them up, you know, whoever feels wants to answer them. First thing is modern heritage immediately brings the swords out from people who believe in archaeological heritage of previous generations, right? Saying that there are limited resources, you know, we are countries with very tough economies. So how do we actually, you know, can the, do you think the advocacy for modern heritage needs to be done within a total context of layers of heritage in countries? I'm not just talking about India, could be Nepal, could be Nigeria, could be anywhere. So that's a question that I would like you to answer. The second question is that valuing modern heritage, you know, so is a country like India, do we have criteria for this, you know, to assess and value modern heritage? If that criteria is there, you know, sort of who actually makes us accountable for it? The third thing is that all the three of you kept on saying about awareness, consciousness, and raising and everything, and people taking ownership. Nishita, you also, you know, finished off with that. Local people feeling that sense of pride that Amita so eloquently, you know, passionately spoke about. And Shika, you know, gave such a fantastic overview. So what is it that we need to do, you know, sort of in a huge country like India, for example, or a country like Nigeria or other countries? But let's go, since all the three of you are, even though you work globally, but you're from India, with such diversity, like somebody has asked a question, what about Northeastern India? I was about to say, hey, Nishita is from Northeastern India and she spoke and you got the right champion for this. So a country with such cultural and linguistic diversity, what are the cross-cutting themes with modern Indian heritage? Those are the three things I want to leave with you. Anyone wants to pick them up? Shika, you've been resting a while. Come on, other two have been working hard.
You're on mute, Shika.
Okay. So am I supposed to respond to the queries that were about archaeological versus modern heritage, the Northeast gap and the values?
Yeah, I think if you address values and this bifurcation of archaeological modern heritage, that'll be great.
Yeah. So I'll give two examples, like one for each on how we dealt with it, because this issue of archaeological versus modern, I mean, we faced it when we were looking at World Heritage, you know, for India, for listing. And Chandigarh had been on the tentative list for a long time. The people of Chandigarh were very keen that it goes forward. But if you come to the Ministry of Culture or to the Pan India situation, we have so much of our heritage. You know what the Nepal participant is saying. We had a similar issue that there is so much of, you know, heritage from Kushan or Maurya or Gupta period, which is underrepresented, or even before, or, you know, the Harappan site, so important for us. So why should we, you know, leave that and go forward with modern heritage? Mm-hmm. And that's why our solution was, when we went to Chandigarh, fortunately, because France was very keen to take it forward. And the Ministry of Culture was very happy that when India is nominating, you know, we are using our two slots for sites which may be, you know, earlier or of more value. But we are also doing a collaborative site with France where we are not directly nominating it, but it goes as a transnational. So it was really a win-win situation for us. We could actually put, you know, Chandigarh on World Heritage, which was lying there for years, and we could do it as a transnational. It was our first transnational site in the true spirit of UNESCO convention. You know, it's a collaborative effort to protect, share heritage and celebrate its outstanding value. At the same time, India did not, you know, lose upon its archaeological, architectural heritage or the slot that they wanted for their own country. So I think, I mean, the situation changes. Each layer, each historic layer, whether it's archaeological or modern, is important. And given the situation, we have to work out the best possible way. It doesn't mean that if we are doing modern heritage, you know, there is, we can't save archaeological heritage. If we are looking for funding, you know, Getty Foundation has a special slot for modern heritage. then one can apply there. There are other slots of funding for archaeological heritage or other aspects. So I would, that's what I would suggest to the Nepal participant, that there are ways to, you know, you can't cut one thinking that the other would get more. So there are, that's one response. On the values, I wanted to explain, this is when we were doing Gandhi Bhavan, and we had the Punjab University as stakeholders, and we had the registrar of the university. The Getty Foundation actually had a workshop in London where they invited not only the experts, but also the stakeholder. So the registrar went with us to London, and for, you know, 4 days, we had a discussion where we were looking at, okay, how is it valued? What is really of value in Gandhi Bhavan, and how do we go about it? And we were discussing on values where, you know, I was trying to explain that why, you know, the base, concrete base of a pool is, does not have value. So don't worry about, you know, changing that, but maybe the panels have more values. And these are the, I didn't realize in those 4 days of exposure that, you know, he had absorbed so much. But when we came back and, you know, we had a discussion where the chief architect and from the university, and there were other members, and we were looking at, okay, so what should be the approach? Because whatever we proposed, we wanted to discuss it with people. And the chief architect suggested, he said, oh, no, we should not do this, and we should, you know, not let go of this material. It is of value. And before I could speak, the registrar actually said, he said, that's not the way you do it. You have to first understand which aspect is of value and which is not. I was just, you know, surprised, and I realized that this is what one needs. I mean, you know, it's just communicating with your stakeholders. They understand that there is a process of valuation. And once they know it, it's your role is done. You know, it's they take over, and they take over the protection of that or conservation of the building.
Thanks, Sheeta. That's absolutely, with such clarity you explain. But the question comes back to, you know, these are not my questions. This is what people, I'm clustering them. You know, is there a criteria? Is there a national criteria for assessing the significance of modern heritage?
Yeah. So to answer that, there is a process of assessing significance. And whether it's archaeological or modern, it is the same process. You know, it has to have an associative value, historic value, architectural value, social value. You know, there are ways. It could have, in case of Gandhi Bhavan, Chandigarh, we could say intercultural value, because it shows the exchange of the French architects with others. So you may need to add a value customized to your site, but there are general values that you start using and you realize the significance. And that's how you establish.
But is there an instrument, like, you know, is there a charter or is there an accepted national instrument?
Yeah, there is the International Scientific Committee of ICOMOS. They drafted a document first in Madrid, the Madrid document. And then Professor Kiran Joshi, who's participating, she helped in drafting the revised document, which is the Delhi document adopted at the ICOMOS General Assembly in 2017. That is a first good reference to really understand what should come under modern.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Okay, now give you a rest. Go to Amita. Amita, you talk very passionately and beautifully, you know, about ownership, you know, the consciousness raising, sense of place and identity. What would it take, you know, to raise awareness of people about modern heritage in India? How would one go about it? Is it through the education system? Is it through the media? Do we do enough work through the media? Amita, over to you.
Thank you. I think that's a complicated one. I think it's as important in a way as a Harappan site, except you can't reuse a Harappan site. I think the great opportunity we have with modern heritage is that it is purposed and can be repurposed. And I think that's, and therefore we can live with it. And I think that offers a tremendous opportunity for people to relate. I think as we go forward, trying to convert what the guidelines drafted for ICOMOS need to now be converted into city level recommendations. And we need to build the significance of these buildings. And when you have that, you talk about it and you have Heritage Matters seminars like yours, we need to value it. You know, it's not just the stock exchange at the back of my street, which I walk past every day. It's an astonishingly important building. It's how, for instance, in Bombay, they have created an incredible public awareness of the Art Deco buildings. And that's really just by continuous communication tools. And I think citizens need to take ownership of their heritage. They need to understand value. I don't say all modern heritage buildings should be preserved, but I think certainly the ones of significance, if we're able to communicate that, and I think we will, will be conserved in the years ahead. We just need to understand the values, the significance, and embrace the effort.
Thanks, Amita. Nishita, up to you now. The whole question of regional diversity, Shika referred to it already, but you come from the Northeast. You had your Eureka moment in Ahmedabad, and it's fantastic, beautiful to hear from you. But how do you think that, you know, we can deal with the regional diversity of India? I mean, like, I come from Andhra Pradesh, and Shika can explain it better than me. You talk about modern heritage, they look at you like there's something wrong with you, you know? And so how would you deal with this in different parts of India, especially as an educationalist? What do you think you can do?
Thank you, Professor Gala. That's a very relevant question in the current context, because as an academician, I'm taking an architectural studio this semester, which is looking at exploring the indigenous architectural narratives of various regions across the country. Because the current pandemic has put all of us in a very strange situations. So I thought of taking this as an opportunity, because at Anant we have students from different parts of the country. So it was a very challenging opportunity that I could put across a studio program where students could study the indigeneity of their own region, which we've been seeing in the recent times that has been fading away. So I think that could be one of the ways to integrate in order to explore indigenous and regional diversity.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you, Nishita. Gosh, you got a long way ahead of you. You can transform the whole of India if you could, right? And but it's your generation that we're counting on. And but let me ask, Shika, you have so much experience of conducting workshops, doing projects, and not only in India, elsewhere. Do you think, what is it that we need to do in terms of heritage studies and interdisciplinary studies in India or elsewhere that you worked? If there are three things that you like to think of, what three things would they be, in terms of we transform, make heritage studies relevant?
So I'm just trying to understand your question. You're saying heritage studies relevant in terms of modern heritage specifically?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I think, Amar, you will appreciate something like oral traditions, that the oral recordings that one finds so important. And what in my first project on, modern heritage, Gandhi Bhavan, I realized that we were fortunate to have everyone, most of the people associated with the project alive. And we could actually do those oral, recordings. So the oral history became so important for that project. And I think that is something essential for modern heritage. There are experts who are just about, 90 plus, and we really need to record because they understand how things were done. We could actually talk to the draftsperson who told us where the stone was, brought from the river, nearby the river, the round stones that were used. So that I think is very important. Secondly, you know, on the material aspect, so obviously the laboratories and testing, and we had IIT Madras doing testing for us, which was really good. But that is something that Getty usually focuses on, is a rigorous study. And that knowledge is not available currently to the, current generation in architectural colleges or others. And that is something which is very important. So we should have, I feel, demonstration workshops, you know, wherever works are being done, because that is the knowledge which is required. So these two aspects, I feel, are very important. And of course, I mean, in our work, whether it was Gandhi Bhavan or Corbusier Museum or any other, the multidisciplinary approach is a must. So we had, you have the landscape architect looking at the modern landscape planning that was integrated, and our landscape expert could actually link, how the trees that were recommended by Corbusier for the entire city and how that linked with the museum planning and the landscape around. So it's not just the building itself, but within its entire context. So landscape experts, the architect, the historian, Kiran Joshi was one of our, history, architectural history resource for the project. An institution like Dr. Sangeeta Bagga with her Chandigarh College of Architecture, she could bring the younger generation, they did the documentation, they looked at the condition assessment, and there was so much learning as part of the process. We had risk management, the mock drills organized by Rohit Jigyasu. So it's, and I had a visually impaired intern at Drona at that time, who actually created the universal access for Gandhi Bhavan, the plan. And he actually also went to the Capitol complex, and, because he wanted to judge the situation, then he came back and he told me, he said, I was just advising those people. They had just opened the tourist trail. And he was advising the person who was managing it, that you should have these kind of things so that, it is more accessible. And the person in charge asked, but why do we need it? So it just shows that there is an extra sensitivity required. And unless you have people from all spheres, you can't really do justice to the project. So
thanks, Shika. As you were speaking, I was thinking, could we clone Shika 1,000 times? Would that be enough in India? I don't think so. India is so big, but thank you. Now, Amita, I want to get back to you. You're involved in the governance of higher education institutions like the School of Planning and Architecture. And I'm not asking about the particular institution that you're on the board of, but in general, do you think our higher education, our universities are responsive to kind of, advocacy that all the three of you have made so eloquently?
It's all about how, I would hope so. I think, I have watched the particular college you're talking about. I've watched them rise to address the challenge. I've watched the expansion of the curriculum. Every time we meet, there's a new dimension, and I think there's every opportunity to expand the dimension. And these are young minds, we've got to make them fly. I think what we need is, to use Shikha's example, there needs to be much more going to site and working practically with, architects and conservationists who are working in the field. And I think certainly colleges are beginning to do that. I know that when we were in Madhya Pradesh and we had many, many projects, the World Monuments Fund, we had a lot of interns coming from various colleges of architecture and wanting to work with the team. So yeah, I think that does. But I think what Shikha is talking about is when you have a project, you need to open it to the nearest College of Architecture to come and join, see, contribute, and work. And that way you would garner a lot more response. But yeah, I do think the Colleges of Architecture are opening up and much more inclusive of a much broader based education system than it was, say, 20 years ago.
Thank you, Amita. That's very, very hopeful, and look forward to it. I think what I loved about Shikha's approach, because I've known her from the field, the way she pulls together teams, it's quite a skill. But it's pulling together those teams is, depends on the interpersonal skills, of the project manager here, Shikha, which she excels in that. Do we teach in our architecture schools, in our heritage studies schools, interpersonal skills, community engagement, ethics of community engagement? Do we teach these things in India? So these are really important, right? Yeah. Nishita, you just heard what was said. And we have a national, I'm getting messages, clone Shikha. But Nishita, you know about the new national education policy that was launched by the government of India.
Yeah.
It's very open to interdisciplinarity research, practice-based research, and a whole range of other things that we see as being, sort of quite transformative, and also could be transformative. It depends on how institutions take up. Somebody of your generation as a young academic, do you think that interdisciplinarity, even though it's in the government policy, it's a little bit confused in the sense it says multidisciplinarity, interdisciplinarity. Multidisciplinarity has created silos, but interdisciplinarity, we have to work beyond the silos. Do you see an optimistic future for this from your young eyes and brains and professionalism, whatever? Nishita, over to you.
Yes, Professor Gala. I am absolutely optimistic about the integration of interdisciplinary education system. Because from my perspective, architecture otherwise also, the curriculum of architecture has always been very interdisciplinary. When I joined architecture, I had a very different perspective that I would be learning how to design buildings. But it came like a shock to me when I was introduced with subjects like, political science and humanities. And when I was doing, later I, found a connection with subjects like surveying and leveling. But then I always found that architecture as a subject was always multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary. And I think, with the change in scenario and the way, we're sort of progressing globally and students, I come across this situation very frequently that students of architecture also are very confused or at times very inquisitive about studying various subjects and linking that with architecture. Because Anand National University is also a school of design, I think at Anand, various pedagogies of integrating certain subjects from the school of design with the school of architecture has worked very, very well. So I see definitely a very optimistic future where it is going to provide, a palette of opportunities to students to pursue what they want to.
Fantastic. Nishita, thank you so much. I mean, another thing that's come up in all the Heritage Matters webinars, this is to all of you, is the same thing, commercialization, commodification. The processes that have very often political agendas are imposed on us. Economic fundamentalism, prevails in many places. So how do we deal with this kind of commodification, commercialization challenges? I'm not talking about all the other Heritage Matters webinars, but here particularly with modern heritage. Anyone wants to answer? Shikha, come on. You fought more battles than people that I've known.
I'm just trying to understand your question. You feel that the commercialization may be impacting modern heritage?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Commodification
of heritage is one thing. Commercialization of, prisons and spaces and everything. And also the other thing, right in the beginning, I talked about decolonization of the discourse. And one of the things that I find very challenging in India is, adaptive reuse is used, but gentrification is not critiqued adequately, you know. So commercialization, commodification, do you think that's going to make it difficult with, you know, with safeguarding modern heritage of India? I don't know. I'm just asking. You have more knowledge here.
In the current scenario in India, it hasn't really impacted modern heritage so much till now. But of course, I mean, because there has to be a realization of that heritage, which is currently missing. So, okay. I mean, it's quite possible that they were removed just considering that it's not heritage. But again, I think Chandigarh is a good example. They are managing the commercialization fine. They have done revamped their sector 17, which is the commercial, you know, zone, but they are so tied up with the bylaws in terms of number of floors, you know, the G+2 and which is consistent. They are doing new shopping malls, but which are on the outskirts. They are even looking at new means of the traffic circles are becoming enough thinkers in the city, fortunately, you know, to come up with solutions. But that is, I would say, that is a way to go. So if one is looking at, there was for the World Heritage of the Capitol complex, we had to face a big issue because there was a multi-story Tata housing coming behind the Capitol, which was in the Punjab area. And we had to really look at whether, you know, the moment you have that structure, your view of the shivaliks with the capital goes away. So that is something the Chandigarh residents themselves stopped. And it was a huge victory for them. So I think that that's, again, like a model that I would say one should follow.
Yeah. Thanks, Shika. Listening to you and reading some of the work, Chandigarh seems to be like a national demonstration project for modern heritage in India. So what are you guys doing from Chandigarh to have a multiplier effect for India?
Well, I mean, I'm not from Chandigarh.
So. I know you're not, but you worked a lot there.
One of the participants. I think they are just more focused on their city, of course. But I would suggest that in future, if we have a modern heritage conservation lab or about, you know, awareness demonstration, there was one that Getty organized, you know, the Getty Conservation Institute, which was between Ahmedabad and Chandigarh. That was a very good exchange. So I think that's what we should use it, like it became a laboratory for modern construction during the time of Corbusier. Chandigarh should be a current, you know, a living lab for modern heritage conservation today for entire India.
Somebody asked a question quite earlier on. Do we need Getty or somebody to come and do this? Why can't we do these things in India ourselves? I'm not asking you to answer this, but maybe Amita can take it up. I mean, I think we all recognize that, you know, the international engagement has been critical for us to address a whole range of issues.
I think one thing is in India, we don't invest in knowledge.
Thank you.
Everybody wants the project done quickly. We were asked to do one in Calcutta just a few months ago. And I said, it'll take us 1 year to study the building. Nobody has, at our cost, nobody has the time. They don't want it. They want everything done next week. And I think that's a little bit of a hurry. And, you know, Shikha will tell you at Gandhi Bhavan, and we're going to do the same in Sardar Patel, it's going to be a year or 18 months of just learning the building and learning its values, its significance, and how to put it back together. I mean, they have 2 years of work behind them before they now implement the project. And that, I think, is a big weakness in India. Nobody wants to spend that extra time and money. And yeah. So hence Getty fills that gap.
Yeah, well, that's a challenge. What do you think, Nishita? Nishita, are you there? Can you unmute?
Nishita, you're on mute.
Okay. I don't know whether she's there or not, but you know, you all have so much experience, and everywhere in the world, you know, you have the political, economic context in which you have to work. But then, in many parts of the world, we have very strong national professional bodies that the governments actually listen to, parliamentary committees listen to. Does India have such advocacy bodies in India, strong ones, that governments listen to?
Perhaps not strong enough.
Why is that? Is that because we started late with these advocacy bodies, and I belong to a generation where I can say that, you know, some of our professional bodies are so divided, you know, sort of like ICOM for a long time had its problems, ICOMOS did, until Rohit Jigyatsu and all of you came together to relaunch ICOMOS India. Have we lost some critical time in not being able to have that depth?
I don't know. I think, you know, for instance, Shikha's description of the citizenry of Chandigarh engaging in the protection of the city. I know from many years of in and out of Bombay, how much the citizens of Bombay, and that's been singularly a citizen movement over 20 or 25 years to protect their heritage. And so it's those kind of movements. They have a similar movement in Delhi, but it's more government-oriented and less people-oriented. So I think that needs to turn around. Everything in Delhi is government-oriented. So the people's movement in Delhi becomes necessarily government. But in Bombay or Chandigarh, it's a people's movement, and it's had paid great dividends.
Yeah, tell me about local government in India. I mean, I'm asking Shikha, Nishita, and you, what role does local government have? For example, Kerala has very good legislation in terms of its local government, and it has its own benefits. We have state, territory, union, local governments. There's a whole hierarchy of governments. Cutting across the hierarchy of governments, does this Delhi Charter actually provide a framework that Shikha mentioned?
I think, you know, a local government is, of course, the best way to carry it forward, because they are the strongest, you know, to actually implement the works.
Yeah.
And that's what has happened in Chandigarh. Now, Delhi is a different case, because in Delhi, you have the central and the local working together, you know. So the Delhi issue comes because there is a central state, you know, duplication, and at times there is a conflict there. So it becomes more complicated. So I think Delhi is a very different case, and we can't really compare it to any other place in India. But what Amita has said about Mumbai or Jaipur or Pondicherry or others, you know, Chandigarh, there the local government is what matters. If they've made a special heritage committee, and that committee is, you know, so it's the locals associating. They've, you know, asked the government to make a committee. Now everything goes through that heritage committee. So there is a local law protecting it, and it works very well.
Thank you. Thanks, Shikha. Thanks for the clarity. Nishita, do you want to add?
I'm so sorry, Professor Gala, but I lost track completely. There was some internet connectivity.
It's okay. Let me ask you all a final question. You know, primary industries in India are the largest employers. Tourism before pre-pandemic used to be the second largest employer. Does modern heritage, does it have potential, within the framework of India's, you know, promotion of tourism? I mean, does the Ministry of Tourism take this into consideration? I'm not just asking all the three of you. And Shikha, what do you think? I mean, so you've dealt with both tourism and urban development. Does modern heritage of India have a future within the framework of tourism?
Well, again, I mean, that is the tourism that Chandigarh has capitalized on. They used to never have visitors, and suddenly with World Heritage and Capital Complex, it's become...
But you worked all over India. You worked all over India. Give us some other examples.
So in other places across India now, if you see, there are, you know, these tourism guides. I would like to quote one of the very good ones that is coming. It's a Spanish publisher, Altrim. And they are doing these guides across India for every city. And interestingly, they're putting on trails that include modern heritage. So I think it's definitely, you know, it's something that can be tapped on in future. And already there are people who have started working on it.
So again, it's Spanish. It's either Getty or it's Spanish. Somewhere else, some outside.
They are not translated in English. It's available in India. And the person
No,
is...
No, not the language. Not the language, yeah. But where the initiative is coming from.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So what are all our universities doing in India? We have a, you know, I think when I was studying, there were a couple of hundred, but now there's more than 1,000 universities. Amita, do you think universities have a significant role to play in this area? To raise awareness within the framework of tourism, within media, right across the board?
Yes, of course. I think universities have a major role to play in primarily valuing what their heritage is, and that it's not, I think we need to get out of this thing. It's not just a 5,000 years ago. It's what we are today and the here and now. And what are we doing for the future? And I would love to see, you know, India invest in an iconic modern structure which redefines a modern India, like, you know, the glass pyramid in Paris. It changed how you went to Paris. We haven't got there yet. We need to go there. We need to have the drive and the ambition to have a great iconic, not in Delhi, structure.
Yeah, but that's let me, I just finished last week a 4-day intensive workshop with 23 professors from 18 universities, you know, coordinated from China and Korea. And the one thing we kept on saying is that everybody says the government, the government, the government. But when you actually look at universities, they're massive. I mean, if you look at the budgets of universities in India, the budget of Ministry of Culture is nothing. So what are our educational institutions? What responsibility are they taking? And how does the new national education policy going to help you, Amita, in your institution that you're dealing with?
Oh, gosh. I think there is a huge opportunity, and Nishita elaborated very well, for transformative pedagogy in how you bring multiple disciplines together, working together. And until we begin to mesh these disciplines, we're going to have a challenge. It's building a building is no longer, and I think post-pandemic, we're going to have to think it completely afresh, is the building has to have meaning to the city. It can no longer just, it's not going to be malls anymore, let's be frank. It's going to be a building that has to be embedded in the city and in the future of the city. It's got to be aspirational. I think bringing disciplines together, revising how we look at embedding a building as opposed to planting it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you. Absolutely brilliant. You summed it up beautifully. Now, before we finish, can I ask each one of you, you know, in turn, if there's a particular issue that you think, you know, sort of that you'd like to share with the participants that you feel, you know, has been missed out in this discussion and other discussions that you want to, a burning issue that you'd like to share. Shika, we'll start with you.
Well, it's not really a burning issue, but I just wanted to extend, you know, to the point that you said that the culture ministry has limited budget. Now the HRD ministry, and there were, you know, you mentioned education and I saw it in the participants' query. HRD ministry has lots of budget for institutions and campuses, and it has launched a scheme on recognizing heritage institutions, which again started with that 100-year bracket because you have BHU and Allahabad University. But fortunately, they are open to looking at other institutional, you know, even less than 100 years. So which is a good point, because like Punjab University or the later IITs or IIM, you know, would then come into this. And this would be a good opportunity for modern heritage, not just one building, but the entire campus, you know, being protected.
Thanks, Shekha. That's actually fantastic what you just shared. Okay, Amita, one last thing, not a burning issue, but any kind of issue.
I think we need to talk modern heritage much more. We don't talk about it enough. And, you know, in India, frankly, we're so burdened with our Taj Mahals and Agra forts and so on. We really need to talk about modern heritage as belonging to you and me, as opposed to our forefathers.
Yeah. Nishita?
Yes, Professor Gala. When I, in my talk, I already mentioned that when I came to Ahmedabad, I came here with a question. I've been exploring that question for a very long time. And that's the reason why I also put it out to all of you that, you know, what are the possibilities, you know, that we could explore to value our modern heritage. And I think I also discussed about, you know, some of the ways that we could deal with it, out of which I think I missed out on one, which I would just like to add here, is that, you know, if we could add more programmatic inclusions to some of our, you know, modern heritage, I think it will bring more value to the society. And I think it will also make the society cohesively participate in, working towards the existence of the modern heritage.
Thank you, Nishita. All the three of you have been, and Eric, have been fantastic. It's a very difficult area to deal with. That's what I found coming, you know, back in India. I don't have the experience that all of you have back in India. But I think that we need to have more conversations, and we need to have conversations outside our own portraits. You know, like it's not just our own professional bodies, our own networks, but we need to have more interdisciplinary engagement outside our areas of endeavor. And second thing is there are a whole range of opportunities that are there in the new education policy. It's a question of how we take advantage of it. And then, you know, India has got such big push for public-private sector, and the way, you know, Shekha, Amita, you know, they put together teams. I mean, sort of it's fantastic, but that's a skill that needs to be taught. How do you put together teams? How do you put together interdisciplinary teams, you know, based on anticipated outcomes, not because I know so-and-so, I know so-and-so. I've seen Shekha being very strict in the way she engages people in interdisciplinary teams. But how do we take this forward? What are the ethics? You know, we have ethics, for example, in India, we have ICOM, ICOMOS, IFLA, ICA, and all these professional bodies. Each has their own code of ethics. And how do we actually work towards a shared code of ethics, not only in India, but it's also needed elsewhere in the world, those codes of ethics. I can tell you, in Australia, I was the keynote speaker in 1989, the first time and only time ICOM Australia and ICOMOS Australia ever met together. So professional bodies too, we need to collaborate more, to come together, work together. In a small country like Australia, small in population, 25 million, we have 16 heritage management programs, which would compete with anything in the world, you know, as good as any in the world. Can we count 15 in a country with 1.3 billion people in India? Can we? I know the answer is almost impossible. And to what extent? Shekha referred to oral history. So much of India is transforming so quickly, you know, but the living heritage, the intangible heritage, India is a state party to it. And are our institutions, the educational institutions, you know, I'm not talking about exceptions that we've got on the panel, but in general, actually taking into consideration an integrated approach to tangible and intangible heritage. And why is it, you know, despite whatever years of, you know, freedom and independence, India still uses the colonial dichotomy of nature and culture. You know, yes, it's in the World Heritage Embedded, but we don't have to use it. You know, nationally, we don't. We can take a holistic approach. And because it was very much a colonial, you know, bifurcation that was imposed on Africa, Asia, and elsewhere. So this is why when India was hosting the ICOMOS General Conference, I was so excited that I changed my membership from United States to India. And why I was excited is that, hallelujah, here is going to be a fantastic opportunity for the beginnings of transformation, the beginnings of things that are Indian, where we take the best of the global, but we also take the best of that which is Indian. Yeah? And I think these things are possible, in my opinion, only when universities become responsible and relevant and engaging, working with the, you know, different areas of the heritage sector. So it's been wonderful. And I know all the three of you, I mean, Shika is engaged, Amita is engaged with educational institutions. We can all bring about changes. My generation has failed in many ways, but I'm looking at young Nishita here, and I must take responsibility for our failures in my generation, but I think that, you know, the future looks good. Thank you very much